The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
You've probably heard that phrase, school of choice, used when describing public education options in Michigan. But what about a school of no choice? Such was the case for many Native Michiganders. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk about our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. With November being Native American History Month, pleasure to welcome Eric Hemingway, Director of Archives and Records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, and the Director of the Michigan History Center, Sandra Clark. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eric, before we break down the school of no choice, would you describe for us what Odawa education looked like as Europeans first began arriving in Michigan?
Odawa education was very community-based, very land-based, a lot of interaction between tribal elders and the youth as people started to transition into elder status within communities and they couldn't perform a lot of the hard duties of hunting, fishing, and gardening. They would pass that knowledge on to the youth. So there's a lot of interaction between uncles, aunts, grandmas, and grandpas with a lot of the children of the community.
And Sandra, how did things start to change after the War of 1812?
Well, the War of 1812 is really that last chance that the Native people have to find allies to fight what turns out to probably be inevitable, which is the settlement that the United States brings with it. You have real pressures on Native people. The term used was to become civilized, and civilized meant that you were Christian, that you went to school, and that you farmed.
So as things began to change, Eric, we want to focus on Harbor Springs. How did these changes play out on the ground in Harbor Springs?
They began to play out slowly at first after the War of 1812 concludes. There's not a lot of daily change, but as Sandra said, the inevitable wave of settlers was going to hit, and not just the wave of settlement, but the emergent American policy towards natives, and that is civilization policies that would deem everything that's about a Native person to be savage, uncivilized, heathen, pagan. These are all terms that are commonly used in a lot of government records describing Native people. So as these policies began to be implemented throughout not just Michigan but throughout the United States, these changes affected appearance, dress, subsistence, education, economics, all of this for Natives. And up in Harbor Springs, a big push was education. Education was seen as a tool not only to civilize Natives, but then the Odawa flipped it and said, well, we're going to use this to combat all the changes that are going to occur to our communities. So they were preemptive, and they started to educate their youth in Western standards very early. And one of those methods that they used was sending them to schools down in Cincinnati, seminary schools, but they also worked with the local church to build a mission school in conjunction with their community. They were being taught in their native language of Anishinaabemowin, and as technology progressed, they were actually printing materials in their native language. But this would be deemed uncivilized, it would be deemed savage by later standards, and that would stop by the 1880s.
Sandra, how did things shift again with this change of attitude in the 1880s? What was going on?
In the 1880s, now you're past the Civil War, and this is the time when you have the Indian genocide, I think it's fair to call it, in the western part of the United States. You have armed conflict between the United States and Native people. And one of those army people manages take some Apache to Florida. He cuts their hair. He makes them wear uniforms and act like white people. He says, this is the way you'll save the Indians. If you don't like what's happening in the West, take the Indian out of the Indian. And so the idea is to found these Indian boarding schools where Indian children will basically not be allowed to be Indian children anymore.
And Eric, how did that focus on, and I'm going to use air quotes here, civilizing Odawa students, how did that play out? And what were the conditions of the schools like?
Well, this idea of civilizing Natives was widespread, and the individual that Sandra is referring to is Richard Pratt, and he has an infamous quote of, to save the man, you have to kill the Indian. And so the system that they deemed the best way to do this was the Indian boarding schools. And the boarding schools varied from community to community, but we had one here up in Harbor Springs. It started out as a mission school that was in conjunction with the tribe and the local Catholic Church. But as federal policies dictated Indian education into the 1880s, the policy said that Indian language was forbidden, Indian dress was forbidden. So when these kids were going to these schools, they were forbidden to speak their language, they were forbidden to practice their traditions, and in a lot of cases, they were forbidden to interact with their siblings or their kin. These schools sometimes were for 1 or 2 years, but sometimes they were for several, and some of the kids actually went to schools outside of their communities. So we had kids from Harbor Springs who went down to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, Genoa, Kansas, and they would be at these schools for 4, 5, 6 years at a time.
I'm looking at a photograph in your story, Eric, about the Holy Childhood of Jesus Indian School in Harbor Springs. And here were all these children in their uniforms in 1895, separated by gender, for vocational training in particular. What kind of education did these children get?
Well, the education that was primarily for these children was that of being a laborer. They were not, you know, training these children to go into higher ed to be lawyers or doctors. They were expected to go right into the labor force as maids, nannies, carpenters, work in a printing press. So that was really the goal of the education, but also to teach them to read and to write, but also to uneducate them on being Odawa. That was as equally a mission of these schools as educate them in a Western standard. So when these kids were at the school, if they spoke their language, they were reprimanded in many different ways, either physically or emotionally, so on and so forth. So to deprogram them out of their Indian mindset and to program them into a Western mindset was happening simultaneously.
Sandra, by the 1920s, views about these schools shifted again. How so?
They were very, very expensive. So you're just coming out of the First World War. The federal government is paying for bringing these children up, for their housing, their clothing, all of those things. So there is a expense reason to cut the budget and to close the schools. And the threat from Native people is perceived in a very different way than it was when the schools were first started. I don't think that their stopping doing it had a lot to do with people looking around and saying, gosh, we really shouldn't be doing this. But it simply was a very expensive thing and perhaps not needed anymore.
Were they all closed down, or, Eric, did the school in Harbor Springs outlast the others?
It did. And once the granddaddy of all the schools, Carlisle, closed, I believe in 1924, a lot of other schools just started to follow suit. As Sandra said, a lot of this was due to funding. These were expensive to run. They had to house the kids, feed them, clothe them, pay for staff, and so on and so forth. So when the funding started to dry up, so did the schools. But what makes Holy Childhood an anomaly is that it keeps going for another 60 years. It doesn't close until 1983, and it's the last Indian boarding school to do so.
I think you can hear jaws drop. I don't think many people realize that was going till 1983. Ultimately, what happened? What led to its closing?
Once again, funding. Once the government started to pull funding from these schools in the 20s and 30s, Holy Childhood managed to keep its own fundraising efforts going. And by the 40s and 50s, a lot of kids started to transition into the public schools up here in Harbor Springs, but some still went to the boarding school. And a large number of Odawa from the Little Traverse community and other communities as well went to that boarding school up until the 50s and 60s and sometimes the 70s.
We open this segment by using a phrase from an article, Eric, that you wrote for the Historical Society of Michigan. Why do you call these schools that are intended for Native people school of no choice?
I use that title because when you look at the history of these schools, these Native children all across the country had no choice to be themselves. They had no choice to pursue their indigenous beliefs, their indigenous language and culture. And this foreign alien system of thinking was imposed on them at a very early age. At the critical fundamental years of development, they were taking these kids from their homes and their community structure and putting them into these oftentimes abusive, abrasive, harsh environments. And it was not by their choice. The repercussions of these schools are still felt very strongly to this day in Native communities all through North America and Canada included.
Spell that out for us. What kind of lasting impact has it had on Native communities?
Loss of language, I think, is one of the biggest impacts. When these kids were at the school, they were forbidden to speak their language. And loss of culture, tradition, spiritual beliefs, community ties, family skills, and we hear devastating stories of kids who survived the school and they grew up to be our elders, and you know, they talk about the situations they went through and how that affected their ability to raise children and develop relationships with other people because of what happened to them at the boarding schools.
It is certainly a key part of Michigan's history, isn't it, Sandra?
It is, and I think it's a key part to understanding a lot of things that happen today. As Eric has said, this is a generational trauma. It's not something that dies with the people who lived through it, who were told that their culture had no value. You see the effects of it still today, and if you don't understand that, sometimes you have a hard time understanding what Native people are saying or why they are taking various positions and why they don't trust some of our Euro-American institutions.
Sandra Clark, director of the Michigan History Center, and Eric Hemenway, director of Archives and Records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Thanks to both of you for educating us on this very long, complicated history of Native American schooling in Michigan. It was great talking with you.
Thank you. It was enjoyable.
Thank you very much.